Can God be found in the Declaration of Independence? Well, just in time for the 250th anniversary comes a new book, Declaring Liberty. Is the Declaration of Independence relevant today? Dr. Paul Jaley is the president of Plymouth Rock Foundation, and he's the author of this new book. I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point, and we welcome back to the program Dr. Paul Jaley. Paul, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, listen, great to be with you again.
Sure. Now, I know that you, since we've dealt with each other through the years, I know you know just about as much as anybody alive about the Pilgrims, and it's interesting that you're expanding your knowledge about the Pilgrims for, you know, the founding era, which takes place about a century and a half later. It's almost as if, though, the seeds the Pilgrims began to plant in Plymouth ultimately bore fruit in Philadelphia, 150 years later.
Yeah, that's true. And the fact is that some founders were actually, you know, like Sam Adams was called the last Puritan. Well, you know, when he writes to George Whitefield and whatnot, he's not just talking about the Puritans. He's talking about the Pilgrims when he talks about people who came here for liberty. So this idea that they were coming for liberty of conscience, the Pilgrims, yes, expanded by seed form. Of course, the Pilgrims could have had no idea what would happen after them. But the point is that there's certainly an ideological link.
Well, talk to us about God and the Declaration of Independence. And first of all, what would you say to those who might say, well, you may have some God talk in the Declaration of Independence, but it's just what the Supreme Court once labeled in a different context, ceremonial deism. In other words, they don't really mean it.
Right. And the foreign fact is that may have had validity if we didn't know what the framers believed. But these individuals were real three-dimensional individuals. They were very prominent in their own denominations, with Presbyterian, Congregational, Anglican, and whatnot. They were very prominent in that. There's plenty of books that identify their religious beliefs, which they lived out privately, not just in a public way, in the sense of trying to make a show of something. Keep in mind also, when they're writing the Declaration of Independence, they're doing this under the threat of treason. They didn't just pledge their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor. They paid that price, and many of them did personally. They were hunted. Once that declaration had been, publicly known in England, these things began to happen. So the idea that they just ceremoniously used it is very cheap, actually. It's a very shallow kind of argument. In fact, we could go even deeper, and the actual phrases used about God, whether it's providence or God as creator, and all these things were very commonly understood as well as being distinctly biblical and Christian. The idea that somehow it was just a veneer or a Renaissance type of idea. Of course, the Renaissance didn't really totally flower till after the Declaration anyway. So these ideas of the God of the Declaration, I have one chapter in the book where I just talk about the God of the Declaration. Let's take the phrases that are used in the Declaration and compare them with how God is talked about.
Sure, sure. In fact, I think the first one that's mentioned is the laws of nature and of nature's God. Okay, what is that alluding to?
Right. Yes, and of course, when you talk about Blackstone in the 1750s, and you talk about even the writings of John Wise in the late 1600s, a pastor up in Ipswich in Massachusetts, these phrases are phrases codifying the fact that God has revealed himself theologically in natural ways in creation, as well as specifically in the Bible. In fact, the laws of nature and nature's God is a phrase that literally means the laws of nature and the laws of God. Or as Blackstone put it, you have that natural law God revealed in nature and then God revealed specifically in the scriptures. And as Blackstone says, upon these two foundations, all civil law must be based. I think what happens is today, when you take a declaration and a document like this, and it is read today, whatnot, we're so far removed from the theology of the 1700s and the way these individuals were educated that it's foreign to us. We think that it has to be couched in the kind of Christianese we're comfortable with, but really this was theologically based and far deeper than mere rhetoric.
You know, I've read Sir William Blackstone, whom you mentioned a few moments ago. He wrote four volumes, but basically commentaries on the laws of England. It's my understanding those books were more popular, perhaps, in the American colonies than they were in his native England. He never came here to this country. But when he talked about how the Creator had impressed upon his own creation his law in all of his creation, but he said this world is fallen, therefore the Creator supplemented his revelation in creation itself with divine revelation, and this is found only in the Holy Scriptures. That's exactly what you're saying. Okay, so that's the laws of nature and of nature's God. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights.
Exactly.
So doesn't sound like evolution to me, although evolution comes later.
No. Yes. And the point is that that is delineated in the scriptures in Genesis 1 and 2, where deliberately God is the creator. He's created mankind. And that was very often referenced, that our rights, the rights of life, liberty, property, all these things are identified and delineated initially in Genesis, especially the first two chapters of the book of Genesis. So this idea of creator, and keep in mind that there were many other religions at the time. And not many of them, if any of them, deal with God as the one that bestows unalienable rights. Because think about it, that unalienable means it's part of our nature. You can't separate a human being from the right to life, liberty, property. Of course, they have qualifications to them because of the fallen nature of man. You can lose your life by taking someone else's. You can lose some of your property by stealing someone else's property and all those kinds of things. But the point is that these concepts are theologically based.
All right, now
in the scriptures.
Now, the phrase life, liberty, and property, very commonly used at that time. What does the pursuit of happiness mean? The pursuit of happiness.
Right. Well, when Jefferson penned the Declaration, he was part of the committee. And, you know, John Adams and others said, look, you're a better writer than I am, and you go ahead and write this. If you go back and trace that phrase, you find out that life, liberty, property, of course, was what was being understood. Pursuit of happiness is a phrase that was used in the Virginia Declaration of Rights. It was used also in several other documents as an expression of property, meaning that the ownership of property and more strictly the stewardship of that property, since God is the ultimate owner of all things, that stewardship of property is what brings you the greatest satisfaction, that someone has the fruit of their labor. They can live with the fruit of their labor. So this idea is a very clear concept of labor when it comes to the ownership and stewardship of property. And that's why the founders at that time and the framers made it such a qualification that you would truly be the best steward if you learned how to own and take care of property.
You know, if the left, we've seen how the left has distorted things, the right to life. Okay, they distorted that. The right to liberty, they've distorted that. But if it said life, liberty, and property, the left would turn around and say, oh, see, everybody deserves property. In other words, kind of like liberty or equality of outcome, not equality of opportunity. Equality of opportunity, that's a good thing that we want to pursue. But the equality of outcome, who can guarantee that? And when you try to enforce that, you just end up with communism or the bloody French Revolution.
Exactly. And the point is that when you look at the Declaration, none of those things are a guaranteed outcome. People have added to that. They've recognized it. But this idea of outcome-based things, that somehow we're going to promise everyone the same. Listen, John Adams wrote about this. Others wrote about the fact that equality, the meaning of equality, we're all created equal, is a very distinct meaning of position before the law, opportunity before God. You can make the best of the worst situations. Think of the number of people that we could point to in American history that had started on the wrong track, so to speak. Even individuals today that are in high positions, regardless of race, regardless of gender, regardless of all those kinds of things. And how did they get there? What was the most inspiring stories are stories of people who, through their work ethic, through their character, and through their integrity, they began to be understood and recognized and actually change it. Think about during the Revolution alone. You have Phyllis Wheatley, an African-American slave, a female up in Boston, But her integrity, her character, her writing of poetry changed people's minds. It changed their entire idea. And this is the powerful way that we see this happening. And these are the truths lived out in the Declaration. And they're so powerful because they are rooted in the Scriptures and the Bible. And those of us who believe in that recognize this is mere evidence of what it takes when you really accept the Lordship of Christ, and also when you take the Bible as it is written and recognize, gee, these values transcend society. They transcend culture. They transcend time period. And any nation can claim these same values and have tremendous blessings even today.
Wow, that's great. Okay, we have less than 4 minutes to go. There's another reference to God in the Declaration of Independence. They said, "We appeal for the rectitude of our intentions to the supreme judge of the world."
Right. And of course, all of them understood from their theological background in their various denominations, the theology was very similar, just the mode of discipline in the church, the mode of government, and the various denominations over in the colonies. And when they look at the supreme judge, they recognize, listen, we'll give an account to everything that we do on earth. There's going to be a throne of judgment. And this idea of consequences in eternity for conduct, attitudes, and what we do on earth was very prevalent in all of their minds. They would have all said, "Well, of course, we're gonna end up before the bar of justice." And by that, when that gets diminished in a culture like it is today, when people feel like there are just no consequences, you're not going to get perfect justice on earth. But if there's a consequence of what's going on in eternity, it regulates people's behavior. And this was very conscious to those writing the Declaration. That's why they said, "Look, we're going to let facts be given to a candid facts to a world." Because we need to say this is the rectitude of our offenses. This is the rectitude of our intentions. We want to be judged by this properly because they knew. And by the way, that's the actual meaning of oath. When you take an oath before God, to follow the Constitution, you're going into public office. Inherent in that, if you look up Webster's 1828 dictionary, the way it's used at the time, you are asking God to judge you if you fail to keep it.
Okay, we have only 2 minutes left. And by the way, as far as the Bible and the word judge, we see in John chapter 5, Jesus is the judge. We see in Matthew 25, Jesus is the judge. Would you say that the founders who gave us the Declaration of Independence understood that Jesus in question?
Yes, they would understand. They would have understood for sure. They called him the Savior of mankind. They called him the Lord. Look at all the proclamations for prayer written by the Continental Congress. They're not bashful in looking to Christ as the judge.
All right. And the final reference to God in the Declaration of Independence, they mutually pledge to each other their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor while having an dependence upon the divine, the protection of divine providence.
Protection of divine providence. Right?
Yeah.
Right. The doctrine of providence was very prominent. The doctrine of providence is simply a derivative of the sovereignty of God. It means that God is the one who moves history in the direction that he chooses, and he times events that you look back on. Often you can't see the providence of God until you look back on something and you realize, wow, this was uncanny that this could happen. The providential hand of God was so evident in the Revolution and the timing of events. Washington referred to it. So many others referred to it that Washington said he'd have to be worse than an infidel not to recognize the providential hand of God in our affairs. And this was the idea that God is the one ultimately that is and his kingdom on earth as it is in heaven.
Paul Jaley, again, new book, Declaring Liberty is the Declaration of Independence, relevant today. Is there a website for the book or for your organization? Please.
Sure, just plymrock.org, www.plymrock.org. It's available now.
All right, Dr. Paul Jaley, thanks very much. All the best.
God bless.